Hello and welcome back to The Sound of Economics. I'm Nicholas Barrett and today we are discussing the details of the European Green Deal, which were announced in some sense today. I'm joined by our resident climate policy expert, Simone Tegler-Pietra. Simone,
hello.
How's it going?
Good, all good. It's a good day.
A good day. Good, I'm glad to hear that. So tell me what happened today.
Well, today Ursula von der Leyen unveiled her plan for European Green Deal.
And with the European Green Deal, we are aiming higher.
There is a communication that has been published by the European Commission and as we speak, the President is at the European Parliament to discuss this proposal with the members of the Parliament. As expected, the communication is a very general document. It's a sort of high-level shopping list encompassing all the possible elements that fit into this Green Deal vision, this Green Deal project. So we have everything from carbon pricing to investments to just transition to farm to fork strategy, agriculture policy. So it's a very wide and not so detailed document. This represents the start of a journey and therefore should be seen as a framework document for all the initiatives that will be undertaken over the next years. I think that this document translates into basically an official paper what has been already outlined in the political guidelines at the time. I think some elements show some differences. For example, on carbon pricing, the tone is very prudent as far as the extension of the emission trading system to other sectors is concerned, which might entail the fact that there might be other options such as carbon taxes at the national level being also considered. We have a quite significant difference in the Just Transition Fund item. Initially, this was called indeed the Just Transition Fund, and now this is called Just Transition Mechanism.
Well, just so, for anyone who doesn't know, what is the Just Transition Mechanism supposed to do?
Yeah, the Just Transition Mechanism is supposed to take care of particularly the regions that are highly energy intensive, or take the example of the coal mining regions, really likely to suffer job losses due to this energy transition entailed by the Green Deal. And the Just Transition Mechanism will be about financing the reboot of these regions from being carbon energy intensive to being green and open to new sectors, and this will also entail not just the financing part but also the training and the capacity building part. And how Ursula von der Leyen put it in the speech is really going to be a combination of the EU budget funds plus the European Investment Bank support and also private investments there. But what has to be outlined that is in the document released today, there are no figures on the amount of money that the Commission intends to use for this initiative, which means that this bill is still on the negotiating table in Brussels.
So, I mean, it could just be political sophistry, but I assume there's a difference between a mechanism and a fund. A mechanism sounds like something that might pay for itself in some way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it has now to be seen how they will structure it. The fact that it has been actually postponed to January, because this was supposed to be presented now in December, it's a clear indication that there is this is a highly political issue and there is political negotiation going on also between the different parties in the parliament, by the way, different approaches. And of course, there is a geographical cleavage because you have the eastern states claiming for more money, while other countries, and I think France was quite clear there, said, well, these regions should also find their way out during the transition without EU money. They should use their own resources to do that. So there are also people that are not calling for double digits in EU budget investments into these funds because they think this is something that should be dealt by at the national and regional level itself.
So you've said that today is a good day, but you've also said that the tone of the document you've seen was kind of prudent and cautious. Can it be both? And is that because you're hoping that by putting forward a kind of prudent and cautious set of proposals, you can get possibly sceptic countries like Poland, Hungary and Czech Republic to maybe not reject it straight away or to at least bring them to the negotiating table?
Yeah, during her initial speech, during the presentation, President von der Leyen said this is a man in the moon moment for Europe.
But this is Europe's man on the moon moment. The European Green Deal.
I think what we are living today is actually the start of the process of building up the Apollo 11 spacecraft. And we have a very long journey in front of us. So I would really see this as the beginning of the journey towards the man in the moon day, which will be in 2050 when we will eventually reach climate neutrality. The reality is that beyond the momentum that we are currently seeing in town on this, this is going to be difficult. And I think that the political difficulty of putting together a European Green Deal is ironically being already shown today, because as few moments before the president entered the plenary at the parliament, there was the news that EU countries led by France and other countries that have nuclear power in their energy mix have opposed, so have blocked, a taxonomy directive, which means which is a legislative initiative to define what is green and what is not green in terms of also of defining green sustainable investments.
What they're essentially saying is nuclear power should be considered a green source of energy and therefore should be eligible for funding as part of the European Green Deal.
Exactly. While other countries that do not have nuclear power are strongly opposing this, saying that we have to invest on the green new technologies from wind to solar, etc. And this is a sign of how countries could be divided in these issues. And the taxonomy initiative is very important because it's a prerequisite to then really also have, for example, a review of the EU fiscal rules to allow countries to, for example, have green investments, public investments exempted from certain fiscal rules we have today in Europe. Okay, so this is very important. And the fact that has been blocked by certain countries moments before the talk of the president in the parliament is just a sign of how this journey will certainly be politically very bumpy.
In your opinion, can Europe, or the world for that matter, decarbonize without nuclear energy?
Well, I mean, I think that is certainly a component of our energy mix, and it's a fundamental component of the energy mix of certain countries, starting with France. So we cannot take that into consideration. Whether this should fit or not into the taxonomy is another topic, which I don't think is our issue today. I think what is here important to outline is the fact that countries have very different backgrounds, very different interests here, and therefore the way the Green Deal is viewed can be very different as well. So after the initial momentum and the initial buzz, the work will need to be done. That will be the implementation work. That will be the challenging part. I think that with today, the easy part of the European Green Deal is gone. Now the work will start, and the real work will start when the hashtag EU Green Deal will not be trending anymore on Twitter.
But now we have, I mean, this is perhaps a problem of multilateralism in a way, is that if you have this plan which pertains to save the continent from a terrible fate of climate change, we now have 27 member states who can all take it hostage for their own various desires and clauses and their own niche interests, which will surely mean that the whatever the European Green Deal becomes or is executed will be watered down and diluted.
Well, I think that's actually also the strength of this initiative, you know, to be holistic, to bring all different elements together in a consistent policy framework. In the past, we have experienced how countries could water down, for example, climate and environmental proposals and initiatives at the EU level, because when you are discussing individual climate initiatives one by one in an individual manner, then they can go under the crossfire of different countries and so on and so forth. So now the challenge and the idea is to bring all the elements at the table and therefore try to find a way to give to each country something that goes in its interest, and at the end of the day, being able to create a coherent policy that works for all. I think that's the basic idea behind and underpinning the Green Deal. I think that's a sensible idea, which should be supported. It's good. And of course, the implementation will be difficult, but shouldn't this be difficult? We would have already reached climate neutrality years ago. I mean, of course, this is a challenge, but we need to move. We are the first in the world to go strongly in this direction. We need to pursue this journey.
Now, you seemed quite sceptical when Ursula von der Leyen said that this was now Europe's growth strategy.
The European Green Deal is our new growth strategy. And this time it's...
Yeah, on that I'm quite sceptical, it's true, because I think this is not going to be really a growth strategy for Europe. It's going to be a major reallocation mechanism. This Green Deal is all about reallocating brown investments to the green field. Is about switching jobs from traditional industries such as the oil and gas or coal or the internal combustion engine cars to electric vehicles, to renewable energy for the energy industry. So it's a lot about reallocating. And when you are doing this reallocation, you are not necessarily creating growth because you are basically shifting parts of the economic sector from one way to the other. By the way, in this move, you might also have job losses entailed. You, of course, will have also job creation, but also job losses. So at the end of the day, I don't really know if this is going to create growth. Actually, if we look at the economic literature, the estimations are not going in the direction of showing that such an initiative will create additional economic growth, because this is not really the purpose of the initiative. The initiative is to favor, is to accompany this reallocation of factors in the economy and in the society. But I'm not so sure this will have the growth and jobs creation component that we might tend to advertise today. And here I think we need to be very cautious and we need to be transparent and honest to the people. It's not to be taken for granted that this initiative is a growth initiative, is going to be the silver bullet for our economy, certainly not. But this is an indispensable step to be taken, because without such policy, we will not be able to act on climate change mitigation, but also, I would say, on the fight for our own local environment. This is also about air pollution reduction, water pollution reduction, and so on and so forth. So this is very important for the daily life of citizens in Europe as well. And after all, we also have to consider the cost of not acting in this direction. We have recently seen the situation in Venice, and of course, that's a very, very vulnerable and unique example and city. But it's true that climate change adaptation will come at a cost in Europe. So we need to act, because the cost will be high in any case. And let me also say that while pushing for this agenda, of course, as many now point, will be costly. But it's also true that this will entail major savings for Europe. And I think about the energy import bill we pay every year in terms of importing oil and gas from producers outside Europe. And I also think about the healthcare associated cost from, for example, air pollution, which are massive costs for the European system every year. And with a strategy that pushes decarbonization and a better environment, these costs will also be reduced in the future.
Well, I suppose the rationale for calling it that, or at least labelling it a strategy for growth, is that if you don't label it a strategy for growth, it'll come into conflict with other strategies for growth. So the politicians might think of it in a way as, oh, it's European Green Deal or this economic plan and so forth. But if it's the same thing, there's less conflict. But do you think that's just not going to stand up to scrutiny if the European Green Deal doesn't deliver economic growth and is therefore regarded as some kind of failure, even if it does cut emissions?
That's absolutely true. And I think that here you need an additional step also to be explained to policymakers and to all, which is that this is also very much linked to globalization. Certain industries that will have to close down because of this decarbonization journey we are embarking in will actually close in any case due to lack of competitiveness, for example, vis-a-vis Chinese competition and so on. And this is particularly also the case of coal mining in Europe. It has been estimated that if we are to respect the 2030 climate targets we currently have, 160,000 coal jobs will be lost in Europe by 2030. But of these, 110,000, so the vast majority, will be lost in any case because those are not competitive anymore vis-a-vis the Chinese competition. So managing the climate transition, let's say, it's very similar also to managing the globalization adjustment that we have already had to deal with in the past, more or less successfully. It's a very similar animal we are talking about. That's why, for example, when we did our paper at Bruegel on the key pillars for the European Green Deal, we said, when you are building up a just transition fund, look at the experience of the European Globalization Adjustment Fund, because the challenge is very similar from a social perspective. It's very, very similar.
And now we've got this document here today, the actual draft text of this European Green Deal. You've got it on the table here, fresh off the printer. What does it have to say for people who work in industries that are vulnerable to decarbonisation? Does it have anything to say for them?
Yes. The main issue here is that this is now an issue that is clearly recognised. Recently, we had the opportunity to have an informed discussion during a BBC program with one of the founders of the Gilets Jaunes movement in France. And my take there was, well, that movement could actually, in the long run, have had a positive impact on the European climate policy. Because before this social reaction came up, frankly speaking, we and the policymakers didn't really recognize the order of magnitude of the social implications of decarbonization. So that was a wake-up call, and it was an important one. Now, we are aware of this issue, and we know that if we don't get the social dimension right, the decarbonization process will fail.
And is there a Gilets Jaunes footprint in this document?
Sorry?
Is there a Gilets Jaunes footprint in this document?
Well, I think that all this emphasis on the social dimension is actually coming from there,
but
from the streets of Paris.
And
also when the president today illustrated the strategy in front
solidarity.
Of the parliament, she started,
therefore,
not by coincidence, but the just transition
immediately
mechanism.
Immediately in the next year, we will propose the just transition mechanism. It will combine public
so
money.
So that's really the, if you wish,
money,
the key pillar of this
the
initiative.
European Investment Bank,
because there
leverage
is the clear
it.
Recognition that that's the fundamental prerequisite for to let this plan work. We cannot do this without having the people with us and taking care of the ones that will be inevitably left behind, because there will be people be left behind by this transition, is a fundamental prerequisite.
Okay, let's talk about globalization. Yeah. If the EU wants to globalize its decarbonization values, as it were, it's going to have to apply environmental standards to trade deals. Now, that's going to open Europe up to accusations of protectionism.
Europe is the largest market in the world with 500 million citizens. And we have to use this leverage that is given us by our own internal market to make a difference globally in terms of climate action. We cannot allow our continent to go climate neutral with massive efforts, while on the other hand, importing dirty products from outside or seeing other players from China to India to the US and so on, not going the same direction. So the question is, what can Europe do to push others towards the climate neutrality goal? And I think that our internal market is a strength. So if we were to put stronger environmental standards for the products that can be sold on the European market, for instance, that will prove to be a major element to push other countries that want to access the European market for their products to catch up.
And those products will be more expensive for Europeans?
Well, not necessarily, because technological advancements allow industrial processes also to become greener and cleaner without necessarily additional cost at the end. Think about an industry that is powered by coal and gets over time more and more powered by renewable energy sources, for instance, right? I mean, you certainly have an initial capital expenditure, which are quite high, but then over time you will get your energy for free. So, of course, there might be additional costs, and in some cases there should be additional costs. And think about aviation. I mean, what is the reality of a plane ticket costing 5 euros for an intra-EU flight, which is less basically than a train, regional train ride, or even in some cases an underground ride? Well, that's clear that in that cost there is no internalization of the pollution costs that one is generating, and that's not fair. So we also need to internalize the negative externalities, as the economics textbook says, and price carbon in a way that is sensible and gives all the incentives also to change.
And is that part of today's plan?
Yes, of course. I mean, carbon pricing is a fundamental part of the European Green Deal plan. And that's exactly what we were referring to at the beginning. So the idea, for example, of extending the emission trading system that currently covers only half of the emissions in Europe to other sectors, or whether having another system that favors, for example, the setting of minimum requirements for carbon taxes in transportation and in heating systems across Europe, and then leaving national states deciding their own level according to the national circumstances. This is all debatable, but this issue of the carbon pricing is a major component, a major pillar of the European Green Deal plan as well.
And of course, a lot of green campaigners, a lot of environmentalists are philosophically opposed to globalization in and of itself because of all the transportation of people and goods from all over the world. That can't continue, can it?
Well, can you be more precise?
Well, I mean the current rate at which globalization is enjoyed by typical Europeans, having food from all over the world almost every evening, having wine from all over the world, flown in from New Zealand and so on. Yeah. That can't continue, can it?
Look, if you look at the scenarios for decarbonization basically by 2050, made by the European Commission itself, you see that we could reach this in different pathways. We could invest in technological innovation. We could have behavioral change. Should we be able to push behavioral change and really let people be more aware of what they are consuming and the environmental footprint of what they are consuming, the transition will certainly come at a far less cost. So this is important. And I would really like to take up your example. Think about for the hipster fashion out there, the avocado toast has become a sort of a status over the last few years, and we all know that these avocados have to fly all over the Atlantic to come over here from Latin America and so on, and so they are extremely carbon intensive, right? Do we take into consideration, is everyone aware of the carbon footprint of an avocado while finding it on the shelves of the supermarket? I don't think so. So one concrete initiative that could be done by this commission as of tomorrow is the one of pushing for a labeling campaign for all products sold in the European market, showing the carbon footprint of that product. This revolution that has to entail the behavioral change has to start with information. And we are still not entirely informed. Well, some segments of the society are. The most interested ones have downloaded apps for the smartphones that could help you to track the carbon footprint of the goods you find at the supermarkets, but why don't we institutionalize this? And this is actually what we did for buildings. Because if you think about the energy efficiency classes for buildings, that's exactly this system. We did the same for certain equipment at home. Think about when we buy a refrigerator, we buy a TV. We know exactly which kind of, which level of energy efficiency our device has. Well, why don't we do a similar system of labeling for the carbon footprint of products? Because I am sure that with this information, we could already experience a significant deal of behavioral change, and this would support the transition in a very sensible manner. This is a typical competence of the EU to do this stuff.
Well, I kind of think about climate change in terms of the tragedy of the commons, because the environment is like a common resource everyone has access to, and each individual, whether it's an individual country, an individual corporation, or an individual person, has an incentive to exploit it for as much as their individual desire, as it were. And in the Tragedy of the Commons essay, and I think it was 1958, Garrett Hardin actually wrote that a bank robber sees money in a bank as a common resource. And we don't try and persuade the bank robber not to take that money out of some kind of moral obligation. We have laws and rules to stop that from happening. In the same way that we stopped the ozone crisis with a rule and an agreement, not an appeal to consumers. So I wonder if there'll be lots of people in the next years and the next decades to come thinking, well, should this be a decision that consumers are allowed to make?
Well,
the tragedy, even with all the information.
I think, first of all, the tragedy of the commons is exactly the, let's say, the theoretical framework that one could adopt to look into this climate change challenge. That's, for example, what I typically do with my students at the university. And that's very important because it also tells you a lot about the free riding issue, right? Because you're right. I mean, the atmosphere can be well seen as a common pool in which something that is emitted in India is impacting a European, exactly as what is being today emitted in the streets of Brussels will also impact the Chinese. I mean, that's a common pool, and that's therefore leading to these problematics of free riding, in which any country could say, well, let the others move first because the costs are higher at the beginning and so on. So let the others move first, because you don't see immediately the consequences, the positive consequences of your climate action, for instance, right? So you wait for others to move first and to assume those costs. But, and I think this is really also well reflected in the document today of the Commission, climate change is one side of the coin. The other side is local environment. Again, wherever we do for climate change mitigation is useful to clean up the air we breathe every day, is useful to clean up our seas, our rivers. So we have to see these in a very broader manner. And I think that we should also promote this initiative to citizens in this way, saying clearly that if we decarbonize transport in city, to be very concrete, this is not just being positive for climate action, this is being positive for our kids. When they go to school in the morning, they will breathe clean air. And rephrasing this action in that way, you're going to avoid this tragedy of the commons. You can start avoiding free riding problem, and you could really justify these plans.
But everybody knows that already. So we have toxic air in Brussels. We have toxic air on the streets of London. People know that driving their cars is creating this toxic air. Everybody knows that them as an individual, by stopping not driving their car, will make almost no difference whatsoever. And so everybody does it anyway. Mm-hmm. There's nobody in these cities who is unaware, I think, of the damage they are complicit in. So I don't know if appealing to the general just by informing countries and people of the damage that's going on.
No, that's not sufficient. That's one way that could provide you a partial answer. But of course, that's not going to be sufficient. Absolutely. You need to act. And in this case, you simply need to internalize the cost of the pollution into what you are doing. And therefore, you need to have a proper carbon tax in the transportation sector. And of course, while doing that, you need to be very cautious. Because while raising the cost of gasoline at the pump, you need immediately to put in place compensation measures for the low-income people that could not afford that fuel price rise. And that's, again, what the Gilets Jaunes movement has really taught us. You need to take that very seriously. And it's a matter of fairness, because people in city centers, as you said, could switch to public transport because we have metros, we have buses available and so on. But in the rural areas, not always you have these alternatives at hand. And therefore, you need to respect this diversity and you need to make sure that the ones that do not have alternatives can actually get compensation if they have no economic possibility, for example, to buy, you know, an electric vehicle, which is the case in most of the cases.
Mm. I just wonder if we'll get into a situation where some European countries might end up coercing others, such as the Czech Republic, Poland and Hungary.
Absolutely. And that's exactly why over the last months, Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary have opposed, for example, the adoption of this climate neutrality by 2050 target at the EU level. On Thursday this week, the countries will meet again in Brussels, also to learn about the European Green Deal and to talk about the 2050 climate neutrality again. I think with this plan, we might actually go in that direction to have all on board for this very simple reason that this time we are also talking about the just transition and we go back to square one. I mean, if you put all the elements at the table, raising targets, raising level of ambition and so on and so forth, while also compensating and giving an economic support for the ones that have to catch up and are in a more difficult situation, I think that's exactly what is needed. It's actually the only thing you can do.
Is this document going to be a useful precedent for other areas, other countries, other continents? Well, is it? Do you think it could be a sort of early draft, perhaps, with a few edits of an American Green New Deal, for instance?
Yes, absolutely. I think that as far as global green deals are concerned, next year, 2020, will be a defining moment, because what will happen next November with the presidential election in the US will be defining not just for the domestic politics, for global trade, but also for global climate action. Should a new president enter the White House, there is high chances that this president will embark into a Green Deal project as well. And therefore, we might end up in a year in a situation in which we have the two big economies, Europe and the US, having the same vision and the policy toolkit. And that could prove to be very important to push other ones, starting with China, in the same direction. This would also facilitate strongly the adoption in Europe of certain measures, such as the carbon border adjustment, because should the US do the same, then we would not fear trade retaliations from the US as we are actually fearing today. And that's one of the major stumbling blocks in the current discussion about carbon border adjustment in Europe. And therefore, that will be certainly a game changer, yes.
Mm. Now, you spent almost the last year, maybe the last few months, working on, obviously, you've written a memo to the commissioner responsible for climate. And you've also written a paper for us on your four pillars, how to make a European Green Deal work. In terms of policy, now we're going to move into a phase of kind of like negotiations and implementation. Does this become a game of political strategy? What place do researchers and policymakers and people like yourself, think tanks, how does it go forward from here? What kind of role do you play?
Well, I think that, you know, the big thing here from our perspective is that for the very first time, we are expanding the boundaries of climate policy. This is clear that it's not only a matter of energy and climate policy as it used to be in the past. It's full macroeconomics now. So, for example, at Bruegel, we are trying to push this issue of really analyzing the macroeconomic dimension of climate policy and the macroeconomics of the Green Deal, basically. Because that's really where the future challenges lie. How do you make sure that you get the investments? How do you put the social employment dimension in order? These are the fundamental elements. And the reality is that these are areas that have been largely neglected in the past. So we are really entering into a new phase, which I think is exciting. Next year, 2020, as far as the Green Deal is concerned, will be mainly the year of the investment component, of the just transition component, and of the industrial policy component. Those are the three big policy areas we'll be working on in Brussels, and the Commission will be working on, because they will have to present something on these three elements next year, together, of course, with the European climate law, so the enshrinking into law of the 2050 climate neutrality target, together with the new 2030 targets. While 2021 will be the year in which we will have to go back to the individual dossier, such as the emission trading system, the renewable energy directive, the energy efficiency directive, and so on and so forth.
Excellent. So I was just thinking about how today Ursula von der Leyen started her speech by evoking the Schuman Declaration about how in the 40s and 50s, Europe agreed to combine the coal and steel industries of France and Germany to make war materially impossible. And that organization eventually evolved into the common market and what eventually became the European Union. And so for the first 50 years of its life, the European community was basically regarded as a kind of peace project to stop World War III from happening. But for the next generation of Europeans, perhaps those born after the start of the Cold War, it might not be regarded in such terms, and the success of the European Union as a project will be purely about whether it can actually protect people from climate change or perhaps mitigate the costs of that. So do you think from perhaps in the years and decades ahead, the European Union will actually be primarily an environmental organization?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it will be an environmental organization, but I'm quite convinced that climate and the environment will remain at the top of the agenda for years to come, because the challenge is not going away anytime soon. What I think is that climate change is certainly, just look at the data of the Eurobarometer, an area in which citizens of Europe are asking a strong EU action. So there is a consensus in the society that we should do something together at the European level on this, because there is a clear recognition, that's common sense, that acting together in this global challenge is far better than acting on an individual country level basis. This is also good for our competitiveness, if I may. Think about what was done, for example, yesterday. There was a big news in Brussels around the fact that seven countries in Europe have come together, putting their own funds together in order to foster innovation in batteries. And that was allowed by the European Commission for the state aid rules and so on. This is important. This EU Battery Alliance, as it is called, is very important, because we came a year ago to the recognition that Europe was lagging behind in batteries, and we were giving all the future of batteries to China. Upon this recognition, the Commission started this initiative, and then countries joined, and the idea was the only way to do this is to act together. We have different expertise across Europe, we have different know-hows, let's work together with inter-European projects to foster this new industrial sector, which is, by the way, exactly what we did with Airbus. So there are sectors in which only together we can act, and beyond Airbus, and let me also recall what we are doing with the Galileo system for the GPS and the development and so on. So there are sectors in which we can only act together to get leverage, and that's certainly also the case of climate. And I would also like to say something here about our foreign policy, because this commission, now today, of course, we are only discussing the Green Deal dimension, but this commission is a commission that has stated its willingness to become a geopolitical commission, right? And the point here is that Europe should make its voice in the world clearer and stronger. And I think that this is also related to the Green Deal. Think about, for example, electrification in Africa. Africa is a continent that suffers from lack of access to energy in a very serious manner. Billions of people without access to electricity, clean cooking fuels. That's an area in which we could provide investments to allow European companies to move into these markets that are strongly growing, to make their investments, so we can accompany them through the European Investment Bank and the EU funds. This is industrial policy. This is climate policy, because it fosters renewables while, for example, electing these countries using coal and so on. And this is foreign policy, because when you do, for example, electrification, you are doing development policy, you are doing foreign policy. So this is a really important field which we could also use for to expand the, in a positive manner, in a constructive manner, the geopolitical reach of Europe, notably in Africa.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for
that. Thank you so much.
If people want to read your paper on the European Green Deal, they can visit Bruegel.org.
Yes.
For more of your thoughts, they might want to follow you on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
It's Tagliapietra S.
Where you follow these things very closely.
Yes, absolutely.
And you are going to Morocco. What are you doing there?
Well, we have the Atlantic Dialogues being organized by the Policy Center for the New South. This is a unique platform of dialogue between Latin America, Africa, and Europe. So as of tomorrow, I will be there for a few days.
Yes. Good. And tell them that they can subscribe to The Sound of Economics and get every episode. Thank you, Simone, for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.